The Puppet That Shocked the World. You can exaggerate as much as you want about how a country goes crazy. You can use poetic references from 1984 or read examples from North Korea to show how a country can turn into a zombie state manipulated by media. But nothing can prepare you for what happened in Egypt in the winter of 2014. By that time, the talk shows were all about who wants to destroy Egypt. They were experts who would rotate around the different channels and talk about the different kinds of plots being planned against us. You know those internet freaks, right? Those who see Illuminati signs in Obama scratching his nose with his middle finger? Or those who believe that Madonna climbed 13 stairs in her VMA Awards performance as a sign of Freemasonry? We have the same type of crazy people too, and Madonna is a hot topic for them, because after they shared the videos of her worshipping Satan, they jerk off to the same videos you do. We get it. You are into weird shit. I understand there are all kinds of crazy Facebook pages that share stupid stories, and there are many who believe that kind of shit. But when that goes mainstream and the media starts reporting it as fact, know you are in trouble. So the story goes like this. After we started our show on YouTube, there was an explosion of talent on the internet. Everyone seemed to become an internet celebrity overnight. We had internet-based comedy shows, singing, music, parody, and our own show hosted many of these talented people as guests. During the Islamist era, we brought on a YouTube sensation called Antifahita. She was a puppet, and everybody loved her. Her character was a widow from the Egyptian middle class who had her opinion about everything, love, politics, and even the American elections. The language she used was a play on how some like-minded women would talk. Think of her as a mixture of the church lady from SNL and Miss Piggy. She was hilarious and extremely popular. She was even starring in commercials for the telecommunications giant Vodafone. The creators of the puppet were friends of mine who worked in an advertising agency. All of that was working well until the usual dickheads came and spoiled it for everybody. Antifahita had a Twitter account where she posted her opinions, which were written in the tone of a misinformed middle-class bourgeoisie woman. So, some of those people who have those batshit crazy Facebook pages started to analyze her tweets and her videos. They postulated that she was speaking in code, and those tweets and her Vodafone commercials were messages to terrorists who became active in Egypt and started bombing everything. So far, this sounds okay. Every country has its own crazy people. But when the media began using these people's Facebook statuses and quoted them as reliable sources of information, that's when it became disturbing. Many of those crazy people didn't just spring out from nowhere. They were there from the first day of the revolution. You may recall when I told you that these channels that came out of nowhere were probably funded by the intelligence service. They were always producing these crazy conspiracy theories that proved that the whole Arab Spring was an American plan to destroy the Middle East. Many of the owners of those channels and even some of the people who spread those rumors on those channels posed in photos with the highest-ranking generals in the army. You might think that trolling with this story of the puppet was just a media stunt to increase ratings, but when the legal system gets involved, that is when you begin to worry. The general prosecutor summoned the creators of the Antifahita puppet, and Vodafone found itself in hot water. The prosecutor accused Vodafone of being an accomplice of the puppet to send hidden messages to the enemies of the nation. It begs the question of who had whose hand up the other's ass. One of the anchors known to be the mouthpiece of the regime got a hold of the lawyer representing Vodafone and asked him to clarify the position of the company on these allegations. The lawyer laughed. He could not believe that this could be taken seriously. The anchor shouted, "You should not ridicule the Egyptian people. Those are serious charges and we need answers." This was the state the country was in. A fucking puppet, taken in for interrogation. We tried to get the puppet on the show again, but when I invited the creators onto the show, they told me that they couldn't. The lawyer had advised them not to make any public appearances. This shit was real. Vodafone pulled its TV ad, which was only one ad out of many that were targeted. And it was one company of many, like Pepsi and Lay's Chips and other telecommunications and car companies, who started to have their share of weird accusations. Every slogan was a code. Every commercial soundbite became suspicious. We did the episode anyway, without hosting the puppet. Instead, we showed how every commercial was distorted to force people to live in constant fear. To show people the hilarity of targeting those companies, we made a fake commercial ourselves and started to strip away the commentary, the graphics, the music, the sound, until nothing was left. This was the Egypt they wanted, boring and predictable, like a group of brainwashed grandmas eating bowls of oatmeal. You might think that this conspiracy stuff had no effect on regular people. Well, mostly it didn't. Away from television screens, people can see through the bullshit. But there was one thing I saw that triggered us to talk about this nonsense. A military helicopter was gunned down by terrorists in Sinai, about 5 hours outside Cairo, and 4 officers were killed. At the funeral, and in front of the cameras, a wife of one of the officers screamed at the crowd, "They killed my husband. They want to destroy the country. Get them. Arrest them. Those traitors who helped the terrorists, the likes of Auntie Fahita, should be brought to justice." This sounds like what would be a hilarious scene from Trey Parker and Matt Stone's Team America. But here, no one was laughing. The Super Candidate. Sisi finally decided to run for dictator-in-chief. The people who had shied away from the word coup were now proudly telling us, "Yeah, it's a coup, and we like it. It's a dictatorship, but we need it." But when people like us, who openly oppose Sisi, called it a military dictatorship, we in turn were called traitors. Many people lost their jobs in the media for merely suggesting what we all knew deep down to be true. The religious authorities in the Coptic Church and Al-Azhar Mosque were already giving their official seal of holiness on Sisi. High-ranking Muslim scholars in Al-Azhar made parallels between Sisi and some of the Prophet Muhammad's disciples, and sometimes they elevated him to the same level as prophets. When Sisi visited the church, it was like Jesus himself came, the head of the Coptic Church said. Sisi is mentioned in the Old Testament. The signs are clear, another priest said. The Grand Pope of the Coptic Church sent his priests to America when Sisi was visiting the UN to herd the Copts there to rally in solidarity with Sisi, to show America how much he was loved. Most of the Copts who came out had been living in America for decades after filing for political asylum due to religious persecution under the military regime, the same regime they were supporting now. The same military that crushed those 26 Christians in front of the TV building only a couple of years ago. Stockholm syndrome much? What is wrong with us Egyptians? Seriously. At that time, Sisi's pictures were plastered everywhere, on bridges, covering buildings, on cars. It is said that the number and size of a leader's photo are inversely proportional to the freedom of a certain country. One paper had his photo with the headline, "Christ the Savior." Isn't it cool to have a president who, if assassinated, can rise from the grave 3 days later? You would think that any self-respecting media figure would criticize the fact that we were turning a blind eye to what was happening. Hell no. As a matter of fact, one of the most popular talk show hosts admitted that he had no problem whatsoever with the deteriorating state of the country under Sisi. Yes, I was in Morsi's case when we had power cuts and economic meltdowns, but under Sisi, I am willing to ignore this because we support him for a much higher cause. Morsi wanted to sell off the country. He was a traitor. But Sisi is a patriot. We are willing to withstand the harsh economic conditions under him. Out of nowhere, serious television anchors and talk shows were hosting mystical readers and fortune tellers to talk about the signs laid out by the zodiac. According to these whack jobs, Sisi was going to be the next president. Considering everything that was happening in the country, you really didn't need any special skills to tell you that he was the president already. Hours and hours of footage were spent on these fame seekers out there to tell us about the signs. One of them claimed that Sisi was mentioned in an old parchment that was 3,000 years old. The young people who were once at the front lines of the revolution were now the black sheep of the pack. The same anchors who earlier had hosted those young people on their shows and glorified the new young Egypt that was reborn in the hands of these young people were now openly attacking the youth, asking for the old and senile to rule us because the young just fucked up. A particular journalist who had been on the front line of the revolution and who pushed for young people to take over was now openly contemptuous of the youth, calling them stupid and in need of proper reform. The same journalist who had criticized the military for adopting the conspiracy theory talk became one of the regime mouthpieces, promoting the idea that the young people were used as tools in those conspiracies. I couldn't help but recall when the owner of my old channel told me that Egypt didn't need me anymore. Following the media, it seemed that Egypt didn't need its young people either. After all, the savior was here. The regime announced that there would be elections, and Sisi announced that he would be running an actual campaign. But it was a campaign that didn't really campaign for anything. He didn't need to. There was no program, no plan, and no fucks giving. He doesn't need to promise us anything. He is enough. This was an actual statement from a talk show host. How dare you ask the president for a program? He doesn't need us. We need him. Another host said, I was playing these videos on my show and people were laughing. But in the media, I was accused of ridiculing Egypt's only hope. Maybe I was harsh. Maybe I shouldn't have associated Sisi with his groupies. Maybe I was wrong. I might have thought so if he himself hadn't gone into an interview saying, I didn't want to run. The masses asked me to. They pressured me to do it. They can't come now to ask me for any promises. I have none. The trickery of his language was absurd, making it sound like he was some hapless man on the street whom the people just happened to propel through the ranks because he was such a martyr for them was insane. He bullied his way into this position of power, and now he was acting like someone who forcefully fucked you in the ass and demanded that you be thankful. And somehow, the people were fucking thankful. I was beside myself with disbelief. 2 years later, I was at a Trump rally in a little town in Georgia. The mayor of the town was at the podium, warming up the people for the arrival of the Donald. He was shouting and cheering, but he said one thing that brought back those painful memories of Sisi's absurd campaign. He said, if Donald Trump didn't do anything but build this wall, would you still vote for him? And the people just roared. With Sisi, he didn't even promise us a fucking wall. Sure, we still had our interim president, but he was like a ghost. Even for social events that were held under the auspice of the interim president, women came up to recite poetry, calling Sisi the future groom of Egypt. These women, who were supposed to be poised and respectful, were dancing outside polling stations, chanting Sisi's name and carrying his picture like he was Justin Bieber or some other teenage heartthrob. At the same time, they were sticking their tongues out at their own children for beating them and proving them wrong. Many of those women turned into hateful, horny fifth-grade bullies. It was a mystery to me how hate, fear, and absolute infatuation could coexist. Then I read this passage from 1984 that explained why members of the party were allowed to get married only when the party had proof that there was absolutely no sexual attraction between the couple involved. When you make love, you're using up energy, and afterwards, you feel happy and don't give a damn about anything. They can't bear you feel like that. They want you to be bursting with energy all the time. All that marching up and down and cheering and waving flags is simply sex gone sour. If you are happy inside yourself, why should you get excited about Big Brother and the 3-year plans and the 2 minutes hate and the rest of their bloody rot? So, as Orwell said, there is an intimate connection between chastity and political orthodoxy. Could all those women have miserable sex lives? If so, it seemed that all of their sexual frustrations was being directed toward the biggest love of the country. It didn't matter if what he said in the interviews didn't make sense or some of his solutions were comical. His lovers saw a superhero whom we were blessed to have. Faith trumps reason. After all, Sisi was the savior. Maybe my idea needed to be expanded. We needed male prostitutes wearing Sisi masks to come and secretly pleasure the women into a reason-inducing stupor. Then, and only then, would the country be ready for a true democracy. But again, Jesus only walked on water and raised the dead. Our Savior did much more. He cured AIDS. Don't worry, I'll explain. We've got AIDS! Ultranationalism is a lovely state of mind. It makes you believe that you are the greatest nation on earth. It can drive poor and crushed masses into believing that they are the chosen ones out of billions of people. It can make millions believe that you have defeated the United States of America's 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean and captured their commander while Obama screamed uncle. Yes, more of that still to come. And it can also magically cure AIDS. It was a cold February morning. Writers and producers were in the office discussing the backlash we faced from last week's episode. The fact that we made fun of Sisi's campaign tactics, which could be summarized as, "We really don't need a campaign," caused numerous writers and talk shows to unleash their wrath on the show. I mean, how dare we take this pseudo-campaign lightly? The team settled down and had the usual chat about our previous episode. Now, we had a sensitive issue to tackle. Sisi had just visited Russia, but it was hardly just a visit to share a vodka toast with Putin. The propaganda machine talked about that visit as if we were still in the Cold War. Our TV had 1960s propaganda all over it. If we had black and white TV sets, we would expect Elvis to pop up. Except now we had an Egyptian Elvis, alive and kicking and wearing black Ray-Bans, and posed with Putin for pictures to show Obama that we were moving on. "Obama is having a nervous breakdown right now," one TV host said. According to American newspapers, Obama will shoot himself in the head after Sisi's visit to Russia. That was a headline of a major Egyptian newspaper. Such was the narrative of our media. According to them, Obama was hoisting a huge boombox outside of Sisi's window, blasting Peter Gabriel's captivating, imploring, "In Your Eyes." In America, I saw Trump supporters adoring Putin and drawing parallels between him and Trump. I saw it in Egypt way before that. The narrative of our episode was taking shape. We now knew the kinds of videos we would use, but this time we were really talking about sensitive issues, arms deals, international relations, and refuting the fact that Obama was having a crying fit in the West Wing restroom. We were once again taking a risk by ridiculing Sisi and his image as conqueror of the world, which was considered by the authorities a national security issue. He was untouchable. We were struggling with the second segment. We were trying to make a mundane education bit work, but there was lack of decent material, and we were really forcing it. And my producer rushed into the office. "Bassem, you have to come and see this." We went out to the hall, where the TV screen was broadcasting a huge press conference. Every single person in that conference was in military attire. Did we just declare war? No. It was a ceremony to launch a new military hospital. Another achievement by the army. Interim President Adli Mansour and the de facto President and Defense Minister Sisi were there. It seems they had just been notified of the discovery of the century and had left the ceremony for the people in charge to announce the amazing news. An older man in military uniform with a general's rank on his shoulders started to talk. Once he opened his mouth, we all had a feeling that he had the air of a hustler, or at best, a con artist who made his way selling junkers at a shady used car lot. He was introduced as General Dr. Abdel Atti. He started by stating the fact that Egypt has one of the highest rates of hepatitis C infection in the world. But now we have the cure, he said. We have named it CCD, Complete Cure Device. The pun was quite obvious. CC invoked CC. How tacky could you get? But oh, it got even better. This device will cure patients of hepatitis C in a mere few days, Atti said. Seriously? The most chronic disease known to our country would be cured just like that? By June 30th, there will be no more patients of hepatitis C in Egypt, he announced. The promised date had no relation with the date denoting the anniversary of Morsi being ousted by the army. It was a mere coincidence, of course. I can also say confidently that this device cures AIDS, Atti continued. There was a most daunting silence in our hallway as we watched while army generals clapped at that marvelous announcement. You see, the AIDS virus is a much weaker virus than hepatitis C virus. If you can cure hepatitis, AIDS is just a piece of cake. I had to take a seat as I was watching this. It was too much. The DNA of hepatitis C is quite similar to HIV, he continued. That is why our device can work on both viruses. Our device destroys the virus completely in the patient's bloodstream. Now we have free protein DNA floating in the patient's blood. As you know, viruses are made of protein. This free protein nourishes the patient and brings his health back very quickly. It is as if we took the virus away from the patient and returned it to him in the form of a kebab sandwich. The entire hallway erupted in laughter. Was he trying to be funny, or was he trying to give us a heart attack? Patients who undergo the treatment are forbidden from eating meat because we are afraid they will be overloaded with protein. Instead, we make them run around the track to burn the extra protein. That is why our patients who get treated with that machine are not emaciated and wasted like other hepatitis and AIDS patients. They are very healthy and gain some muscle mass during the treatment. Our segment of the week just wrote itself. I started to assign tasks to the producers and writers and went into my office to recollect my thoughts. Minutes later, Hind came in. There is a sort of mutiny in the office, she said with a big smile. Some of the producers don't want to go with the segment. I went into the editorial room, right in the middle of a heated discussion. What's wrong, people? I asked. We don't think we should do this segment, my team said. But why? I asked. Their answers showed me how effective propaganda can be, even in the place that is fighting it. They are too confident, one producer said. I know the whole thing sounds stupid, but Bassem, this is the army. They will never announce something like this without being 100% sure. Many agreed with her. What if we made a big deal out of it and then it turned out to be true? We will look really bad then. Plus, the army never lies, another producer said. The army never lies. Just shows how deep this brainwashing can run. I just got off the phone with my parents, a third producer offered. One of our relatives is infected with hepatitis C. He is very happy with the army invention and can't wait to begin the treatment in a few months. When I told them we are going to talk about it in the show, my parents were furious. They shouted at me, saying, "Don't you even mention the army in your show. This is the army. They can't be wrong." We were not making fun of desperate CC lovers anymore. We were not satirizing the hysteria that made people believe that CC was as infallible as a medieval pope. If we did this segment, we would be making fun of men in uniform. For Egyptians, that was unforgivable. I brought the discussion to a halt. Okay, guys, I don't want you to think of me as Bassem the TV host. Now I'm Bassem the doctor. Let me talk to you about viruses. For the following 30 minutes, I used a whiteboard to explain what a virus is, what its life cycle is, and why the army's achievement was absolute nonsense. They seemed convinced and went back to work. But I knew that this would not be the end of it. My 19 years of medical education didn't go to waste. See? The next 2 days we were pinned in front of our monitors, collecting material about the new invention. It seemed that there were actually two devices, a system for diagnosis and a system for treatment. The treatment device was, as I said, appropriately named CCD, Complete Cure Device. This looked like a miserable school project, a makeshift ATM that was executed quite badly. The general, who made the announcement earlier, posed proudly next to it with other members of the team. He explained how this device worked like a dialysis machine. The blood of the patient passed through the machine, and voila, it came out free of the viruses. General Abdulati, now identified as the head of the research team, became the star of all the primetime talk shows. He explained that this machine contained two elements with hidden secrets from the days of the pharaohs, which were able to purify the blood of the viruses. Prominent doctors from university hospitals came to the defense of the new cure, hepatologists, cardiologists, and internists who were working under the general came out to say how wonderful this invention was. "We have been working on this for 23 years," claimed one of them. "We had the results a long time ago, but we didn't want to announce it because we feared that it would be stolen from Egypt." "Really? So you had the cure for AIDS right around the time when the whole world was screaming out for relief? Well, thank goodness you kept that shit to yourself. The world needed to see an Oscar-winning performance from Matthew McConaughey in Dallas Buyers Club." The steamed-up general made an appearance at a conference, cameras flashing and microphones peeking out from under his white mustache. He belted out, "I was working in a lab in America. I discovered that invention 23 years ago. They offered me $2 billion to sell the rights to them. I refused, and I said my only condition was for this cure to be in the name of an Arab and a Muslim like me. Then the almighty Egyptian military intelligence were able to smuggle me outside of the United States. I came here to work for my country and for the welfare of my people." This was turning into a very bad sequel of Mission Impossible. Who said you needed to be a Scientologist to be that delusional? The general repeated those claims on another TV show that evening, with the exception that he was offered only 20 million this go-around. I mean, what's a couple of zeros, right? But that was not all. He also announced a new way to diagnose HIV infection. He claimed to be able to diagnose your condition remotely. Sounds like a Star Trek movie, right? Well, wrong. They showed the other miracle device, but it was nothing more than a TV antenna connected to a handle. Yes, a TV antenna that you hold toward the patient. The antenna would just point at and follow you if you had the virus. This brought to mind a famous scandal in 2008 that involved the almighty British Army. A swindler called Jim McCormick sold fake bomb detectors to the British Army in Iraq. He cashed in around £60 million, $80 million. Selling around 6,000 detectors for the price of £10,000 each, the real cost of one device was only around £15. Why are all armies stupid, especially with money? Now that same fake bomb detector was in the hands of the con artist Dr. General in a promotional video made by the Army's Moral Affairs Department. He demonstrated how that bomb detector could find out if someone had the virus or not. He pointed it toward one of the patients, telling him, "Congrats, you used to have AIDS, now it's gone." Apparently, if the antenna didn't point to you, you didn't have HIV. He He then went to explain how sensitive this detector is. Even if the patient is in another room, the device will still be able to detect him. He announced proudly, "If there was a trace of the virus on my finger, the device will point at my finger. If I wipe my finger with a tissue, the device will leave my finger and, like a hound dog, follow the tissue." Doctors who were trained and educated in prestigious medical schools went out to defend this hoax. They explained how the DNA of each virus had its own electromagnetic wavelength unique to it. The bomb detector could be adjusted for each virus's wavelength and could detect it very accurately. Even if the patient was in another room, the detector will point to the patient with the wall separating them, said one doctor, a real fucking doctor, working under that con artist Abdulati. This occurred during another primetime talk show. There were two doctors from the team working under General Abdulati who went on praising the genius of the general. "You know," one doctor said, "the other day I was in the lab and suddenly I found the machine pointing at me. I was freaking out. But then I remembered that earlier in the day, I was greeting General Abdulati and there must have been some residual virus on his white coat. When he took off the jacket, the antenna pointed to the jacket. This is how accurate our machine is." We were howling at the videos in the editing room, thinking it could not get any better, when yet another video surfaced. It seems that all of the doctors working on the military team were having a collective orgasm over their fake medical achievement. They couldn't stop calling all of the talk shows to demonstrate how incredible this machine was. With the same principle of detecting a virus through its electromagnetic waves, and hence being able to destroy it, we were able to utilize this principle in curing other diseases, one elated doctor said in a phone call with a TV anchor. "We can also use it to fight bacterial infection." "Really?" asked the anchor. "Yes, we have also tried it on many patients with other conditions, and they were healed. We had seen patients being healed from lupus, eczema, psoriasis, and diabetes." "Oh my God," shouted the anchor. "So can it also heal cancer?" "Of course it can heal cancer," asserted the doctor. "Of course. Why not? Just throw cancer in the mix. Because AIDS, psoriasis, diabetes, and cancer have so much in common, and we never knew it. And this has been in the works for the past 23 years, but only now are we choosing to reveal it. Aren't we smart?" This turned into a flat-out propaganda hit job by the army, and the military medical team continued to sell the device even more. And it seemed like they never ran out of diseases to cure. We have noticed that patients with heart conditions and hypertension, after being on our treatment for 2 months, stopped their medications because they didn't need them anymore, said the cardiologist on the team. This was a miracle in the making, a machine that cures viruses, bacterial infections, autoimmune diseases, diabetes, and heart conditions. "You really don't need to sell it harder to us." But for some reason, the military medical team decided to turn this invention into one of those two-for-one infomercial deals with, but wait, there's more special. We have also noticed that patients with sexual impotence had major improvement in their sex lives, added the same doctor. "That's it, people. This was all we needed. If you say a treatment can also give you a boner, that's all that we needed to sell it. Even to healthy people, they might as well have run those interviews as replacements for Extend's commercials." This machine was now named the Kofta machine. Kofta is another word for meat or kebab, specifically the kind of meat you eat on a skewer in Mediterranean restaurants. This name change happened because of the genius General Abdulati, who earlier had said that the protein DNA of the virus could, through treatment, be returned to the patient like a kebab sandwich or kofta. The Friday of our show, people waited to see how we would deal with the kofta gate. We did not disappoint. The audience laughed and howled at every single joke. At the end of the segment, I told the audience, "This was all fun and games, but this is so funny that we should actually be serious about it." I went on to say that this was a scandal, one sponsored by the most competent institution in the country, an obvious reference to the army. I told the audience that this cure was no trial drug. They said they will cure everyone in June. This is called a promise, I added. When you make this promise to sick people and you don't deliver, that is a crime in itself, and someone has to be held accountable for that. The theater was dead silent. The audience clung to every word as they were thinking, what? Can we actually hold the army accountable? That's unheard of. I went on, if you think that we will let this go, think again. If you think that we will just be silent until this is forgotten, we won't. Here on this program, we will remind people every single week about this promise until it turns out to be real or someone is held accountable. The theater exploded with applause. I was taking this personally because the doctor in me was angry. I hate people being cheated when they are sick. I then realized that by speaking out about basic science, that we would get even more heat. This was a scandal, and we thought that by doing our job and setting things right, we would be praised. But this was the army. The army doesn't give a shit about what is right and what is scientific. They care about their own image, even if it's at the expense of the people. Years later, I met the scientific advisor of the interim president, who resigned in protest over this scandal. He too has his share of heat. He told me that he met the head of Sisi's office. When he voiced his frustrations about what happened and even brought evidence that this machine doesn't work, he was told, it doesn't matter if the machine works. What matters is the uniform behind the machine, and this uniform should be respected at all costs. When I heard this story, I was hardly surprised at how all hell had broken loose at the time. When this episode aired, it set a trend in social media like never before. Koftagate was the talk of the town. We realized that if we didn't talk about the machine, it would become another hoax that would be put to sleep. We made it a point to remind people of the promise every episode. The talking heads in the media lashed out against me. They accused me of being a pessimist, who was bringing down the morale of the country by laughing at its army. If the army says it works, then it works, one anchor would shout on his program. You are just jealous of our wonderful army. And to those people I say, die with your viruses, another anchor said with a smirk. The cure works, a third anchor would announce. The security guard at my apartment building has been cured by it. I didn't know if they were in denial, or if maybe I'd lost my mind, and there actually is a new kind of medicine being taught now in medical school, and the cure was actually real. I met doctors who were not affiliated with the military medical team who confirmed that the machine worked. People had to realize the fallacy of inventing a machine that could cure every known medical malady to man, right? A shocking fact was revealed over the next few days. The celebrated general Dr. Abdulati was not even a doctor. Oh, surprise, surprise. He was a lab technician. He was also a felon, accused and convicted of running a sham clinic where he treated people with herbs without a medical license. His clinic was closed down, and there was a 1-year imprisonment sentence delivered against him. People wondered how a guy like that could rise in the ranks to make general in the most efficient and competent establishment in the country. But the denial continued. An anchor proudly announced how Sisi was very happy with the invention, that when he saw it, he cried tears of happiness. It didn't really matter if this was a real invention or not. People just wanted to believe. Months later, when I had to escape the country, a famous TV anchor met me in Dubai and told me that when asked about the AIDS invention in a private meeting with the media people, Sisi answered firmly, "The army never announces anything unless we are 100% sure about it." We kept reminding the audience every week about the approaching June 30th deadline, which was 4 months away. The deadline passed, but it didn't matter. The army, the media, the overexcited doctors just stopped talking about it. Sisi supporters who were attacking the show for spreading negative energy simply ignored the whole thing, and like that, it was gone. I felt that what we were doing in the program was amounting to nothing. Yes, people were avidly following us, laughing at every joke and cheering on every bold statement. But what was the use if no one was held accountable for that scandal? This is when I started to lose faith in change. This is when I saw how people were treating the program as simple comic relief, a way to vent. That's all. People who believed us were helpless, and people who loved CC no matter what were happy in their own ignorance. During this whole debacle, I didn't think of North Korea, which I usually did when drawing parallels to our regime. Instead, I couldn't help but think of Gambia. Gambia is a small country on the western coast of Africa. In 1994, an army general called Yahya Jammeh took over the country through a military coup, and in 2007, he announced that he had discovered an herbal cure for AIDS. He also announced that hundreds of people were healed. For years, this was an undisputed fact in Gambia. WHO workers who objected to that cure were evicted, and those who ridiculed the cure were labeled as part of the imperial conspiracy against Gambia. President Jammeh would appear on television with a leather-bound Quran and a long string of beads in front of a group of people with HIV. "In the name of Allah, you will be cured in 30 days," he would say, raising the Quran above their heads. The British publication The Guardian documented those early days when President Jammeh was rounding up sick Gambians to cure them. Waiting outside Mr. Jammeh's treating chamber, the patients themselves said they did not need laboratory results to tell them they feel better. "It feels as if the president took the pain out of my body," a patient would say. Many poor Egyptians stopped taking their hepatitis C treatment. "Why spend the money? The army will heal us for free," they collectively believed. Reports of hundreds of Egyptians with deteriorating health conditions came to light after the army failed to deliver on its promise. They dared not submit complaints against the army. The television anchors that sold the idea of the cure are still around today, screaming and kicking and finding another bullshit conspiracy to distract the people with. No one was ever held accountable, and as usual, the army and Sisi were untouchable. Every time I read about another hepatitis C patient who was in a deteriorating condition because he waited for the army cure, which never came, I go back to the Guardian report about Gambia and the promise of the 30-day cure. The last few lines in the report went as follows. Amadou Jalou, 25, who quit his job at a tourist hotel after his mother was diagnosed with AIDS. In his savings account is 8,000 dalasses, about 150 pounds sterling. Enough, he says, to last him the 30 days Mr. Jammeh promises it will take to heal his mother. "I'm just afraid that what if my account runs low," he says, "but by then I think she will be cured." I listen. Okay, we are all pretty familiar with the NSA now that Joseph Gordon-Levitt played Snowden in an Oliver Stone film. So remember when Obama was apparently listening in on your phone calls and even tapping into the calls of world leaders? The NSA listening in on the American public was a topic everybody was talking about in Egypt, not because it was happening in the States, but because it was used to justify what was happening there. For over a year after June 30th, 2013, when the coup occurred, some of the worst people were on the front lines of the media scene. They were usually deadbeat journalists whom everyone knew were associated with our own NSA and even our intelligence service. Suddenly, those people were given airtime and their programs were heavily financed. One of those third-grade journalists were hosting a show called The Black Box. This show did one thing and one thing only. It broadcast private phone calls of public figures, specifically those who were vocal against the regime. Now, let's get one thing straight here. No one can record all those calls from different people unless that person is someone at the highest levels of power. Our own NSA was famous for recording private phone calls and using them to pressure media figures, political leaders, people in the opposition, and basically anyone who would not play along. But now, corruption had reached a new level of scum. Those private phone calls were broadcast on a primetime TV show to entertain people while they ate their dinner. The government allowed it, and the patriotic citizens supported it and even rooted for it to continue. A spokesman of the police said, "If you are not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't worry if your calls are recorded or not." The neo-fascists, who revolted a year earlier against a religious rule that might take away our freedoms and violate our personal lives, were welcoming the recording and broadcasting of people's private lives. "We need to know who are conspiring against our nation," Sisi supporters would tell you. If they were innocent, they would have nothing to hide. That was the new standard of human rights in this country. Don't do, say, or think anything bad, and we won't fuck you up. People went to court to stop the black box, but the court and the law belong to the state. This is a form of investigative journalism, the court ruled. We were the only program that came out and derided that show. We showed our audience what a world of free-for-all information would be like, not to mention what a douchebag this two-bit journalist and the others who supported him were. Then, at the end of our program, we displayed the most common arguments those assholes use. A pro-CCTV anchorwoman said, "It happens everywhere else. America is doing it. The NSA is doing it. Here are your democratic countries listening in to their citizens, so we are justified in doing it." Yes, but they don't broadcast it in prime time, you dim fucks. Pulling the plug. As if it were a surprise, there were signs, very strong signs. Working on the show was becoming increasingly difficult. The more popular it got, the more hated it became. It continued to break viewership ratings, and it had the most expensive price for television advertisement in Egyptian television history. Anyone would have been elated to have this show, but with me, it was different. I always had haters and people who would prefer to see me dead in a gutter. I get that. But to be so childish as to jam our satellite signal, the opening credits would play and suddenly the signal would be lost. This had never happened on TV before. We filed a complaint to the Egyptian Media Authority, which said they would investigate the incident. Of course, they never got back to us. The pro-military show started to host experts who hinted that all the dissidents would disappear soon, including my show. "The people don't want him anymore," they would say. By the people, they meant the regime. So far, we had been following a conservative strategy. We couldn't ridicule Sisi directly since he was not president yet. We were careful not to even get him on screen and make fun of what he was saying while he was in his military uniform. He needed to be out of uniform. And above all, he needed to be sworn in for the gloves to come off. We were approaching our first break in weeks, a scheduled and much-needed two-week holiday around Easter, away from a very stressful job. As the break swiftly approached, we had a team meeting to decide what to do next. Then we got a call. The network asked us to delay our return. It seems that they were under a lot of pressure from the authorities. "We need to show goodwill," they told me. "We want you to come back after the elections are over." We would announce that we did that because we didn't want to influence the outcome. Of course, that was bullshit. Everyone knew the outcome of the election. There was no way anyone could affect them. Sisi was running virtually unopposed, and by unopposed I meant that he was running against the ghost of a candidate. One of the candidates in the previous elections had agreed to run against him, perhaps to give some legitimacy to the whole process. Remember, appearances are all that matter. Jesus, it sounds like we are a heartless pageant mom. If Sisi ran alone, it wouldn't look good in front of the global community. Still, the outcome was a joke. Sisi won by 98% of the vote. That challenger came in third. Yep, in a two-man race, the other candidate came in third when the ballots were counted. There were more disqualified ballots than the ones he got. It was a fucking joke. So now we were back and we wrote an incredible episode. I can say that because you will never see it. Actually, no one will. But in my opinion, it was one of the most daring and funniest ones we ever wrote. We were breaking so many taboos that I was sure I would end up in jail for it. This time, we didn't hold back. We got Sisi right there with all the pageantry and empty promises. We were in satire heaven. Then, another phone call came. "Bassem, we're sorry. We have to shut you down." A farewell to arms. I couldn't decide how that phone call made me feel. Was it a sense of deep sadness because they were taking away the thing I loved doing, the thing that I succeeded in, and the legacy that I created? Or was I relieved from the horrible stress I was under all the time? I couldn't really decide. I still can't. The show was gone. I was told that the owner of the network received a call from an army general who was running CC's office. He asked if I was coming back to mock CC, and the owner told him he didn't know, but it would be very hard to avoid the topic. The general told the network owner that they don't prefer my return. When the owner told him that if the network shut us down, other channels would jump on the opportunity to sign up the most watched show on television, his answer was, "Well, believe me, no other channel will dare to do that." Funny, Americans ended up with a president who bitches and whines about unflattering pictures, mean jokes, and SNL sketches, where he's played by Alec Baldwin. Whereas in Egypt, it takes a phone call from the president's secretary to shut down political satire in the whole country. Dictators are so thin-skinned, aren't they? Now, I could be lying. As a matter of fact, I'm making all that up. I'm victimizing myself and covering for my failures because I'm an attention whore. That is what the CC blind lovers would tell you. Do you have proof for what you are saying? Well, I'm not in the habit of recording and broadcasting phone calls and private meetings like their beloved authority would do. So, no. Even if I had gone public with this information at the time, the network would say that I was lying because they would have faced a lot of trouble exposing the story. The denial machine was ready. He was shut down because no one was watching him anymore. It is a Saudi channel. Egypt had no control over it. He was paid $5 million to shut up. He has no principles. Well, Allah knows I wouldn't be writing this book for the shitty advance HarperCollins gave me if that were the case. I was not the only one shut down. I was the last of a long chain of TV hosts who were knocked off the air because they didn't follow the crowd. But there was always a justification for each one. Bad ratings, a false sense of victimization, financial problems with their respective networks, you name it. We held a press conference to announce the end of the show. Out of respect of our network, we agreed that we wouldn't talk about what happened between us behind closed doors. It would just get them into too much trouble. I went out into that press conference saying that ending the show was a defeat, but it wasn't a defeat for us. It was a defeat for a regime that was supposed to be more powerful than us. I said that ending the show was a louder message than anything that could have been said. Message delivered, I declared. We had invited everyone from local and international media. The international media put the story in their headlines while it was ignored locally. One of my researchers who worked closely with a state-run newspaper told me that there were clear orders to ignore that press conference. If it wasn't reported, it didn't happen. As I took the stage for the last time to speak to the reporters, I tried to retain my composure and smile. I was quick with my jokes and even threw a couple of indirect punches at CC, which everyone applauded. I asked my crew to come on stage for a final photo together. After the reporters left, I spent over 2 hours comforting my team. They couldn't believe the show was over. I tried to joke around with them. We took group photos and selfies. We hugged, giggled, and joked around to make it easier. Then everyone left. I was alone in the theater. The security guards told me my car was outside, waiting to take me home. I asked for a couple of minutes. I need to get something from my dressing room, I told them. I went backstage for the last time and looked around at those walls that would soon no longer host the show. I went into my dressing room and switched off the lights, and for the next 10 minutes, I let myself go and cried. A toxic brand. Initially, unemployment doesn't feel that bad. There are no deadlines and no real commitments. I welcomed the stress-free life at first, but soon found out that it wasn't a viable option for somebody who needed to make fun of things. Only a few days after I stopped doing the show, offers came pouring in from Arabic-speaking channels based in Europe and the United States. There were even serious offers from Muslim Brotherhood-funded channels that were now broadcasting from Turkey to bring back the show on their screens for any figure I asked. These were the same Brotherhood channels that had cursed me day and night and accused me of having blood on my hands. They accused anyone who had criticized Morsi of being an accomplice to the coup and had selective amnesia in terms of their army ass-licking days. I couldn't take this show outside of Egypt. Despite all the craziness that was happening there, I would have been looked at as a dissenting fugitive had I gone elsewhere. It didn't matter how stupid and ridiculous those accusations were. Egypt had proven time and time again that this madness eventually takes its toll on people. For a regime like Sisi's, it was in their best interest to prop up imaginary enemies all the time to keep people distracted. A satirist fleeing from the country and getting funded from abroad to attack them would be the perfect gift. Those were not speculations. The regime actually issued laws that could basically put anyone in jail. One of those laws was targeted at anyone who received funding from abroad to get involved in activities that might result in tarnishing the image of the country through spreading false news, incitement of hate, disturbance of the peace, or anything else. Anything else was an actual phrase in the law. You could be sentenced to life in prison or even executed if it was proven that those activities qualified as an act of treason. I could be invited to dinner by a foreign human rights group, and that could qualify as my receiving foreign funding. Or I could make a joke that could be considered an embarrassment to the regime. I decided I would not do the show outside the country. After all, was it worth it? I'd had the most popular show in the Arab world. Had it made a difference to the cause? Did it protect me when I was censored? Did it stop the madness? I was just sick and tired of sticking my neck out for no reason. I was a satirist, not a freedom fighter. I know this might not sound very inspiring, but when your own parents still buy into the propaganda, no matter what you do, and even some of your extended family members share posts on Facebook accusing you of treason, well, that can make you question a lot of things. My fears were confirmed only a few weeks later. I was invited to give the keynote speech at two important conferences in Europe, the Global Media Forum in Bonn and the Oslo Freedom Forum in Norway. I decided that I should have a conservative strategy when I spoke abroad. In no way was I in the mood to confront the regime. In Germany, I avoided mentioning any specific names and speaking openly about what had happened to me or what was happening in Egypt. I told my interviewers beforehand to avoid asking any confrontational questions and that I would give them what they wanted by speaking indirectly about my situation. It worked. The interviews and the speeches were well executed, and anyone with half a brain would understand exactly what I was talking about. Back in Egypt, people with half a brain were pissed enough to make a move. The production company that used to produce the show was raided the next day after my appearance in Germany. The raid occurred under the pretense of someone using a non-original version of Microsoft Windows software. A couple of people were arrested and the computers and other equipment confiscated. It should be a crime to use Microsoft Windows in today's day and age, but not enough to arrest innocent employees. Amr, my executive producer, was summoned to the police station. The officer there openly told him that they did what they did because of me. Let Germany get you out of that trouble, the officer said. It's a warning this time, but if Bassem doesn't shut up, we will be more severe next time. Amr begged me to let it go. Every time you speak, it hurts us, he said. I was blackmailed through my friends and family in Egypt. Maybe it was too much trouble to arrest me, but it was easy for the authorities to pressure me through my loved ones. They had done this before when they arrested Tarek's family members in order to get to me, so why wouldn't they do it again? A month later, I went on my scheduled trip to Oslo. I didn't once mention the word Egypt, and I actually gave a good speech that served my message without saying anything specific. Apparently, I was mistaken. On the way back to Cairo, I then realized that this would be the last time I would see my country.